Welcome to National Treasure Hunt, the podcast where the secret lies not only with Charlotte, but also with your co-hosts. I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And happy National Treasure 20th anniversary, everyone.
Happy, happy. Oh my goodness. The good things just keep coming this year.
Truly. I mean, I don't know if you've thought about it, Em, but this first movie came out when we were in middle school.
That's really scary. How old were we in middle school? Pretty young, right?
Yeah, you start high school around 14. So let's say 11-ish.
It's been a while.
Yeah, but we are so happy to be celebrating the 20th anniversary of National Treasure with you all for the entirety of 2024. Because you can't just do it for one day. That's just sad.
Yeah, I mean, we would be missing out on so much content that we could be giving you, including what we're giving you today.
Yes, I'm so excited to share with you all that we have a new bonus podcast series on National Treasure Hunt this year called NT20 Questions. Really a game of 20 questions to celebrate 20 years of National Treasure. It's very self-explanatory.
Yeah, I mean, it 20 for 20. Yeah, we can't get better than that.
It's so perfect. And today we have NT20 questions with the Wibberleys. You all know them. You love them. We hear you loud and clear when you share with us all of your positive reactions to the Wibberleys coming on our show. And we're very excited to have them back today. We are also really excited to tailor today's NT20 questions to the Wibberleys themselves. So what that means is we're going to be asking them questions about both National Treasure and National Treasure 2, as well as their show, National Treasure Edge of History, and of course, National Treasure 3.
I mean, how could we not ask about National Treasure 3?
Yes, and I think y'all will like what you hear.
Yeah, and I don't know, Aubrey. Can you tell the people some of the things that we're going to ask about?
Yes, we like to think of ourselves as being the mouthpiece for you, the National Treasure fans. So we have been saving up questions from our episode recording sessions, as well as listing all of the questions that you send to us online. All right, so you might hear a question that sounds familiar to you. For example, guys, we are finally going to learn why slash how Agent Sadusky had the Meerschaum pipe and the ocular device and the Olmec plank.
It is about time that we crack that code.
We have heard you all loud and clear. We know you want the answer, and we're going to deliver.
Of course we're going to deliver. When do we not deliver? So clearly we're getting your questions answered. So if y'all have more questions, please go ahead and share your questions, thoughts about this episode on Twitter and Instagram, where you can find us at NT Hunt Podcast.
And we don't want to keep you all waiting, guys, because turns out 20 questions takes a non-zero amount of time to get to, but we know you are going to love every minute of this conversation. So without further ado, please join us in welcoming screenwriters and showrunners Marianne and Cormac Wibberley to National Treasure Hunt. You know them as screenwriters and showrunners extraordinaire, our most frequent, fan favorite, and always welcome guests. Marianne and Cormac, welcome back to National Treasure Hunt.
Thanks for having us again. We love being here.
Oh my goodness. Happy 20th National Treasure anniversary to you.
Unbelievable. That's just crazy.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. it's a great milestone. Yeah.
For great sure.
Goal. Almost drinking age.
That's so funny. I mean, in 5 years, we'll be celebrating the really big milestone of 25, but for now, to celebrate the 20th anniversary, we thought we would play a game of 20 questions with you. We've prepared sort of a combination of fun or silly questions, some deep, more philosophical questions, and then some also some clarifying questions. There have been a number of things we've brought up on the show in the past 2 to 3 seasons of the pod that let's just say we've been itching to ask you. So does that sound good?
That sounds so great. Much fun. Let's do it.
Okay, Emily, you want to take it away?
Let's get into it. So, question one. If you could change one thing about the original National Treasure film, what would it be?
The Rotten Tomatoes score. I mean, we got such bad reviews when we first came out. I mean, that still stings. Like, you, it's funny you think that, you know, it, but it's just like, but I, that's the thing. It's, that's not a very probably nice thing to say. I'm trying to think if there's anything else about the movie, but it's like John did such a good job and Nick Cage was so, I mean, like, how could you, like, and there was another ending originally. You guys know about that, right? Where they didn't find the treasure. Wait, where were they? They kept the treasure. Wait, what was the original ending? You tell me. We had a reshoot because, oh yeah, they didn't get anything. That's what it was. They didn't get to keep any of it. And audiences didn't like that. Because Jerry truly believed, and rightly so, that they couldn't be doing it to get rich. Mm-hmm. So that's how the movie, and that's how the movie was shot. And then months later, audiences tested it, and they hated it, that ending. They wanted Ben and Riley to get the money. So we compromised. Some money. So we compromised. Well, no, we compromised, right? We came up with the idea that they get a tiny bit, but it's enough to buy a Ferrari and a house. And so if you watch those reshoots, there's some reshoots where you can tell Abigail's hair, if you look closely, like their hair had been cut and so they had to wear wigs or they had to be, and you, now you'll, now your eagle eyes will see it in those reshoot scenes. Yeah.
Totally.
I would change it. I would keep the new ending. I wouldn't go back, you know. So.
Well, we're off to a great start because we didn't know that the original version didn't have them getting anything. So awesome. Okay. Well, let's jump into number two. We're going to go back in time a little bit. Let's pretend Nicolas Cage, Justin Bartha, and Diane Kruger, our big three, were not available to film National Treasure back in 2003. Which three actors would you have cast in their stead?
Well, the one that comes to mind, but I don't think he was acting a big enough name. It has to be a nerdy person. So Benedict Cumberbatch comes to mind as a person now.
Who could,
nobody can replace Nick Cage. Let's just always say, we've always said this to you, right, Cormac, that we wrote it with Nick Cage in mind. That was not, you know, but if he had said no, the other people on the list, you know, might have been Brendan Fraser, like, because we love The Mummy, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's a person that I would have loved. I think Ben Affleck was a big deal at the time. I think he might have been on the list because I think he had just done Pearl Harbor. I love all these people, but like none of them can be. I mean, I don't know. What do you guys
think? You're asking the wrong. Ask John. Yeah, or what you guys think?
Yeah, who do you guys think could be? You know, it's hard to find a nerd, you know, from that time, 2004,
yeah, we did a whole episode on this, I think, in season one of the podcast, right? It's been like 4 years since we've answered this question ourselves, but we actually, just like you, we had the hardest time trying to quote unquote recast Nick Cage. The other ones, you know, were a little bit easier, not because the actors and actresses aren't fantastic, but just
You could think that might, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think people have told us in the past, they've been like, oh, Robert Downey Jr. or like, you know, but I mean, it's just.
Yeah. Robert Downey Jr. for sure. Like, I don't know why I didn't think of that. That would have been, he would have been a good Ben Gates. He can be a nerd and a.
And he was busy doing Shaggy Dog.
Okay.
That's a really good question. I think, you know, the other ones are easier. Like Jack Black we didn't know Justin Bartha existed, like in our world. Like, I don't think we had seen Geely yet, or we hadn't thought of, I don't know if he had come out yet. I don't know. It's hard to remember back what your mind what Frame was in 2003 when we were making. But I think when Cormac and I were writing it, we were always Jack Black, because he's here from Formosa Beach, where we're from, and we just think he's super funny, and we just thought he would be a good foil to a nerdy guy. And then we went through a bazillion. Apparently, that was you should have you talked to John about that. That was a really hard role for them to cast, to find the right guy, until they found Justin.
Really? No, we'll have to ask him about that.
Yeah.
Ask Justin. I'm sure Justin does.
Yeah, Justin won't want to talk about you. I don't know if he knows.
Well, if and when we can get a hold of him, we absolutely will.
I know the last time we talked to him, he said he would do the podcast when the next movie came out. But it was like, but what if that?
Justin said that?
Yeah, Justin said that in a text.
Okay. Well, we're just going to double
down. We're all finding things out.
Yeah, we're all learning things, and we're going to double down, triple down on National Treasure 3, but we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Yes. So, speaking of characters, we're kind of going to go towards Patrick. So, viewers still comment on Patrick's National Treasure line, "At least I had your mother for however short a time." When writing National Treasure, were you operating under the assumption that Ben's mom had previously died?
I can say it was an idea that was floated. We can vaguely remember saying, oh, well, she died with him looking for the treasure at some point. But then it became that just ruined his life. And that, as you see in two, it became the backstory. So yeah, I mean, that idea was floated.
Definitely was floated.
And I still kind of vaguely remember John joking about finding her bones in one of the treasure hunts.
but we smartly kept that door open so that we could get Emily Appleton created in two. So, but it's a good question, because, you know, you think about things offhand, you don't think you're going to have a sequel, you write a movie, and then, you know, you're like, oh, thank God we didn't say she was dead, because then we would have had to come up with something as to why she's not. She disappeared on a journey, came back. She was in a Colombian prison, but she's dead.
No, people have asked us that a number of times. They're like, yeah, that line, it makes it seem like she died, but that's, I love that, because it lends just the right amount of the door is open if you get the perfect sequel or the perfect casting. I worked out well.
Yeah, we got lucky.
So another question that we've actually fielded a bunch from our listeners has been related to the heist in the first National Treasure film, where we know that Ben and Riley have planned to steal the Declaration from the preservation room at the archives during the gala, and they know that the document will be in the preservation room because they're the reason it's there, right? They kind of messed with the sensors, they got it moved, so they know where they're going during their heist. To our knowledge, Ian shouldn't know that, should not know necessarily that the document is in the preservation room. So how does Ian know that the Declaration isn't in its normal display case the night of the gala?
Maybe the line got cut, but
I think when an early draft of this, Riley has to go into the subway and cause a power outage, because when there's a power outage,
the auxiliary power
and automatically the Declaration drops down. And Ian was doing the same thing. He was coming in through the basement, cutting power, and Riley had done it already.
Had beat him to it.
So they kind of. So that was in an early draft. So I think they just kind of like stepped over that and used the.
Then we decided
the
that
thing.
And yeah,
it's too expensive to shoot Riley going into the subway, cutting the power when all you could do is a little light, and then it goes down.
Then also there was something, and I don't know if it's in the movie or not, but there was something about whenever they have a gala, if there's going to be like they, for precautionary reasons, they put a fake Declaration of Independence out and keep the real one stored. And that's why Ian knew it was going to be there on the gala, and Ben knew it was going to be there.
And that's something we found out after we wrote a big elaborate paper.
In the subway.
Making the power go away.
But anyway, yeah, so it was a good question.
Oh my gosh, that was a great answer.
Yes. Okay, so over the summer, we did kind of our first series of like on the street interviews where we asked just honestly some random people some questions.
That's so fun.
And you are by no means random people to us, but this was one of the questions we asked, and we got some really interesting answers. What would have to be at stake for you personally to steal the Declaration of Independence?
I mean, it would have to be, well, I mean, it's, of course, if someone in your family, if they're holding someone hostage, like you would feel like that's, you of course try to get the FBI, and I don't think that I would be capable of doing it, obviously, but, you know, if they said, oh, but you have to do it, otherwise we're going to kill your dog, you know, like that would be something. But then also, like, instead of a treasure map on the back, if there was something, you know, else, like a cure to cancer, I mean, like, I don't know. I feel like if it's going to get lost, they're going to destroy it. And it's never going to, I feel like that would be Ben Gates would, you know, I'm not as brave as Ben Gates. I couldn't do it myself, but I feel like it would be worthy of, but what did people on the street say? I'm so curious.
We had a dichotomous set of answers, and these people, very random, they do not know each other. There were about 50% of the people we talked to were like, yeah, I would just do it for the clout, and then the other 50% were like, you know, the fate of the free world, like democracy, and it was like, wow, you really don't get much more opposite than those two answers.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just save the world sort of a thing. Save the world, of course.
Yeah.
You know, but we have to ask AI that question. Because AI might have a really funny answer, because...
Destroy the world.
Yeah, they might say this destroy the world is okay. Yeah. Don't
say
they
might say if they had the answer how to destroy the world.
Yeah. I'm curious.
Oh my gosh. We should do that, Em.
Yeah, you should do it.
Yeah. Okay. I'll put it on the list.
Amazing. Okay, I'm going to shift now into National Treasure 2 land. This is something that Emily and I have debated for years now. We have often remarked about one of the final scenes when Cibola is flooding at the end of the film, and they're in the kind of the cavern where they need to decide who's going to stay behind and who's going to make it out alive. Mitch immediately is very adamant that he will be one of the survivors, and then has this abrupt split second change of heart and chooses to sacrifice himself for the good of the group. What prompts Mitch's change of heart?
Well, I think you have a good answer.
Okay. Well, I mean, when we first wrote it, it was, or even in the movie, Mitch is like out to make a name for his family, right?
He's out there. Yeah.
He wants to make a name for his family. Then he basically rides Ben's coattails. So he's not really making a name for himself through the whole movie. So at the end of the day, the only way to truly make a name for himself is to do the Survivor thing. And what's on your resume? I don't know if you guys watch Survivor, but I'm a big Survivor. We're big Survivor fans. Nice. You have to have something on your resume at the end. You can't just ride on coattails the whole time. So his big move at the end would be, I'm going to sacrifice myself, and then my family name.
I think, yeah, and at that point, isn't he faced with he has a dilemma. They're all going to die,
that's
and
true.
Nobody's going to know, or he can help Ben, and they can escape, but he's going to die. So he's basically, all he was doing this for was to save his family. Or at least get credit for his family. And that when he saw that Ben's a stand-up guy and he's going to do this, then he was willing to make the sacrifice. It wasn't going to go the other way around, I don't think. I think at one time we had Ben. Didn't we kill Ben in two?
What?
No.
No,
they all died.
They all died. No, I'm kidding.
Can't say things like that to Aubrey. She
had a panic attack. Oh my god.
I'm kidding. No,
Cormac loves to tease.
We would never do that.
When we were on the set of middle of the season of the show, Lisette, who plays Jess, came up to us and goes, can you guys just tell us like where our character arcs are going? Because we kind of, and Cormac said to her, oh, you know, you guys all don't make it. And face. And I was like, oh my God, he's kidding. He's totally kidding. He loves to do that.
Well, it's a hard thing on a show like that, because Marianne and I are in this sort of buzzsaw with each episode ahead, like constant notes, constant changing, constant things, and you can't give a script to an actor and it's going to change.
Because it's going to change.
Because it's be frustrating for them. Mm. It's a really hard thing to say, look, we can't give you next week because we're not done with it.
But you didn't have to tell them that they died.
Well, I just didn't want to, because it was a question all the time. You're like, eventually you just go, well, we don't even know if you're in next episode.
Oh my God.
So that, yeah. That's
they're all good sports. Anyways,
I know.
Okay. Well, that makes me feel better about Mitch, a little less good about you, Cormac, but it's okay. on the topic of other villains like Mitch, not you, the National Treasure franchise now boasts 4 unique villains with super different motives. So Ian, Mitch, Billy, and Agent Hendrix Salazar. Who is your favorite villain and why?
That's like asking who your favorite kid is. I mean, because we're all gave so much to, you know, I guess if we had to choose the OG, you know, Sean Bean, he made, you know, if it weren't for them, that movie, nothing else would have grown from that. Everyone, we love all of them. But I will say a special place in our heart for Armando Riesco, who played Agent Hendrix, because he took such heat on social media after he ended up being a traitor. People like sent him death threats and stuff. And like, I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, Armando. We didn't, you know, he goes, oh, it means they did a really good job. It's like, okay, I'm glad you're looking at it that way. People got really mad. So,
really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, and he's kind of fun because he brings the series, the universe full circle, having been in the first. Anyway, that would be mine. But look, I love Catherine.
I think they all had, like, after Sean's, I think they all had bigger, more deeper motives. Sean's was just like, hey, I'm here, son. I want to get that money. And that was it. And we didn't even have to write a giant backstory for him because he doesn't care about the Declaration. He just wants the money.
Yeah, so, made it. You're right.
And
you're
then right. He sold it so well that it was great.
Yeah, he was really ruthless. You're right. And then, but you're right. Then Mitch had to have more family and everything else.
Everyone else has this sort of agenda.
And then Catherine, in order to sell the Billy story to Catherine, we really had to like dig deep to find a deep motivation, the Crossus Nostrum and all this stuff to really make it juicy for her. So you're right. Bigger shoes to fill because of Sean Bean, and then all the subsequent actors filled those and then some. So
for what it's worth, we've done whole episodes analyzing the villains, and we always, those are the types of episodes we go in with like a preconceived idea of where we think we're going to land. And then we have a conversation and then we're like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, we love Sean Bean and we love the original, but like, yeah, the motives of the other folks are a little more interesting and intricate and detailed and like, lets you chew on it a little bit more, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, good. 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 Glad you think that. What did you guys think? Why did you guys think Mitch had a change of heart and then what are your theories on it?
So, Emily, it took us like almost 4 years. We finally landed on the martyr explanation, like sacrifice himself to get to achieve his ultimate goal. But it took us so long to get there. And Cormac, once you mentioned the, just now, the idea of if they all died, he fails. His story is not remembered. Like, that makes it even more solid. But we finally got there. Do you remember like any of the conversations we had before we landed there?
I feel like most of them were just me being like, I don't like Mitch. I don't like Mitch. I don't buy his motive. Like, I don't like him. And so, but thinking of him doing the martyr thing in the sense of like, if I don't do this, then, you know, my name doesn't get remembered. It kind of, to me, fits with, I guess, what, like, my impression of him.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it's funny you bring it up, because I don't know if you look at Mitch, is there any point in the movie that Mitch goes, oh, my ancestors were bullshit. It wasn't true that there's never a moment where Mitch realizes, wait a minute, everything I thought at the beginning of this movie is false, which is normally what a hero figures out and not a villain. So that's probably why Marion and I went, no, he's going to stay. He believes, when he stands up in that classroom, he believes what he's saying to Ben Gates. He's not making it up to con him. He thinks it's true. So I don't think he ever reaches the point where he goes, wait a minute, none of that stuff I thought was real is true. I'd have to watch it.
I know. I don't. You're delving into something.
When he stands up there and you're like, what a jerk. He's just trying to screw with the Gates family. It's like,
yeah,
you know, I get it.
The more we've studied the second film in the past couple of years, I've actually become a huge Mitch apologist. Like, I just think because he is Ben, but a villain. He has the same family background. Uh-huh. He has a more noble goal than just like wanting money, and he does make that sacrifice in the end. But I just think that parallelism with Ben is just so, so cool.
Cross the line and kill people to get it, as opposed to Ben.
Yeah, that's the only. That's really right. Yeah. That's really. It's a little more ruthless, but yeah, they do. They have the same motivation. Yeah.
Okay. I could talk about this all day. Emily would probably murder me because sometimes she has a hard time following the clues in National Treasure too. But we balance each other out. We're gonna move to more recent times. We're gonna talk a little more edge of history now. Very early on in the show, we learn that Agent Sadusky has developed dementia sometime between the second movie and present day. But in retrospect, once we get further into the show, we learn that we really only ever heard this diagnosis from two unreliable narrators, Agent Hendricks and Miles. So it left us wondering, did Sadusky actually have dementia, or was this like a false diagnosis cooked up by Cross S. Nostrom to make Sadusky seem like the unreliable narrator, like someone people shouldn't trust?
First of all, is Sadusky even dead? But second of all.
Oh my gosh, yes!
good point, honey.
Marianne and I always walk this line that he definitely was feigning that in order to, if anyone captured her or tried to torture him like they do, he always had to fall back on of like,
I don't remember.
I don't know.
So he had to pretend.
He had to sell it like he has dementia to them so that there's no way they could get it out of him.
I think, and also originally we said he leaves, he's basically relieved of duty from the FBI because of the tragedy of losing his son. And he does, like, we imagine that he became an alcoholic and he was so grief-stricken. But then he, when Cross S. Nostrum starts coming after him for the box that he stole and everything that he's taken through the Masons, that maybe he's faking his faculties, his diminished faculties a little bit, so they won't come after him or his family like they did. So that was kind of where we were. But it always was like, am I really crazy or am I not crazy? You know, Harvey Keitel is like, and he played it perfectly. So
I love that.
I never thought of that.
No, I did not either, but it's fantastic.
Yeah, we should have handed out the pamphlet before people watched it. So they knew.
I know, you're reminding me, Emily, that we have a chart. Did we not give it to you? We have a chart of the clue in an old, like, Excel spreadsheet of like the Resolute ship, the desk, and if I can find it, I'll email it to you.
Oh my God, please, that would be amazing. That would help me so much.
And you can put it on the screen and it's ridiculous.
Was crazy because Chad Oman kept asking us, the executive, the producer under Jerry, And so Marianne has this spreadsheet with the pictures of everything and all the links. And it's like, oh my God.
Yeah, I think I have a clue trail somewhere. I'll find it.
Okay. Oh my God. Amazing.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
So don't feel bad that you can't find it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, it's the Charlotte, it was the Resolute. And became the Resolute desk.
The Charlotte had, yeah, different, but yeah, the Resolute ship, they made two twin desks. That's
right,
true.
Right. Which,
yeah. And true. We also connected to the Le Boulier and the, and I can't remember now how we did it. I have to look at the chart myself.
I can't remember either. So,
yeah. So I'll pull it up. We'll see.
Right. Le Boulier was a mason.
Yeah. All that stuff.
Okay.
Amazing. Okay. Well, speaking of like all the things that Sadusky had kind of like collected over time, how did Agent Sadusky end up with the ocular device, the Olmec plank, and the Meerschaum pipe in his clue room that we see in Edge of History? The internet and us really wants to know.
Okay, well, this all was inspired by the cutscene of National Treasure 2 that I think we sent you guys.
Yeah.
Where the Masons secreted off with the something that was hidden in Cibola, and you don't know what it is, and it didn't make the cut of the movie, but we had it, and we had it written, and we had it filmed, and Bruce Greenwood, the president, lets Sadusky walk off with it, and so in our head it was like the Masons had so much power.
I mean, who did you last see the Ben Franklin glasses with? Sadusky, he's flipping them back and forth, talking to Ben. Did you ever think he turned it into the FBI? Never. He knew exactly where they were and what they were.
In the evidence room.
But did Ben throw that plank into the river in from the Resolute desk?
One of the planks made it into the river.
I can't believe Ben did that, by the way. The archaeologists who watched the show must be so mad at
he
us.
He got a picture of it.
A really high res picture from a traffic light camera, but a picture nonetheless.
And he knew it would float.
So he had the. So yeah, we just figured their people got it out of the Mitch Wilkinson got it out of the river. Mm-hmm. They got it out of the river, mm-hmm. But then he eventually. It loses its we lose track of it in the movie right after that.
Yeah.
And so we just have to, he burns the letter that Queen Elizabeth wrote. Like, so you feel like he may have brought, you know, we just feel like the Masons got it somehow. We don't have an answer to that. That's a good question.
That was a great answer. Yeah, no. People are going to be so happy to finally know. I mean, Emily and I have spent a lot of time analyzing Sadusky's storage unit and his clue room in recent podcast seasons. People have loved these episodes.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, there's some interesting stuff that set decor in the storage unit and the clue room, like giant coats of arms and things that like normal people probably wouldn't just have lying around, both because they're very expensive and like antiquities. So
yeah.
It's a little bit of a, maybe he's a little bit of a sketchy guy. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes. He was a sketchy guy. Those Masons had their fingers in everything, right?
Yeah, truly. Yeah. Well, speaking of those deep dive episodes, we actually just released one this week at the time of recording where we did a very in-depth analysis of the cork boards in Agent Sadusky's clue room, because there's a lot of interesting stuff on them. We don't know how involved you were with the set decoration or how much you may or may not have paid attention to those walls, but we have.
Nice.
So the main cork board, kind of opposite the entrance to the clue room, has information dedicated to each of the relic boxes. And the section for the jade box features a bunch of like pictures that are National Treasure 2 references. Makes a lot of sense. Things like Statue of Liberty and the HMS Resolute and Queen Victoria, etc. But there's also something curious there. A sticky note on this section of the cork board relating the storming of the Bastille in July of 1789 to Love Independence it. Day. In 1776 of July.
What's up with this Bastille reference? Like, that feels like it came out of nowhere. Was that part of like an initial National Treasure 2 draft, an initial Edge of History draft? Was it a fluke? I don't know. Tell us.
Well, you know, originally, what?
Well, they were inspired by our revolution. Let me back up for 1 second, because in Sadesky's storage bin, and this was in the original script that Marianne and I wrote, and I don't think it ever made it out. There were only three things that he hadn't bought with his cryptocurrency. Everything in there, that's what she figures out. Everything in there, he bought online with cryptocurrency, except for the flag. And what was the other thing? And
except for the gavel.
The gavel and the flag. And she realizes, wait a minute, all this stuff is bull. Just bought it to put it in storage and make it look like it's a storage thing, but he's hiding these three elements. And for whatever reason,
we lost that scene.
Got edited down, and Marianne and I lost that fight of how showing how smart Jess is to realize.
Tasha. It was actually Tasha.
Tasha was
Tasha actually us. Figures it out by hacking the cryptocurrency account, and she realizes
figuring out everything was except for those three things.
He's storing stuff that he doesn't even
that he didn't need.
That he didn't work.
It's
work.
All false clues. He was putting false clues everywhere except for these three. So anyway, on that one. So yeah, I don't think we had anything to do with the Post-it.
So the Post-it, the best deal. I feel like, yeah, there was, you know, it's funny because I looked it up on our old drafts. I said, okay, I'm just going to search for Bastille to see if we ever had it in an outline or anything. And we didn't. So all I can say is our researcher, Dean, and our set Michelle, set her, all her set people, maybe even our art director, they really did have fun with the stuff that they did. And we said, just stay within, you know, the universe, and you guys can have fun filling it out. And I think they really did, you know, because now I'm like, I'm sure we did Bastille. I'm sure Bastille was someone, but I don't think it was. I think that was them concocting little fun clues to add in there on the board.
Right. It's after the Revolutionary War, right? I mean, we inspired the Bastille happens because of what was happening here. So, and then we often said Le Boulier. So I think they just jumped at it and said, why don't we just end the Revolutionary War to the Bastille, which is in Paris, and then just, you know, make people lean in.
Well, totally, I guess relatedly yet unrelatedly, on that corp where there's a bunch of maps, I don't know if you're aware how many Alamo references they worked into those maps that you will notice if you are really paying attention.
Did they do the two Alamos? And they did. I didn't.
There are lines connecting all different versions of Alamo. And then we were like, oh my God, but the Saduskis, they had no reason to know about Alamo. They never cracked the clue that led, you know, that led the kids to figure out the Alamo part. I was going down quite a rabbit hole.
Yeah. The double Alamo thing was such a fun thing to discover. A real piece of history and how that could work into the storyline. And I'm, you know, it's funny because you would think that, and we do, we looked at everything as showrunners, you look at everything, but all we're focused on is, you know, the things that are going to be called out with the script and make sure that they're there. And then also, of course, the experts were telling us, you know, you can't do I can't remember, a silver box or something, because they didn't have silver, you know, like you couldn't mess up, like, because otherwise the experts would have your butt, like, so we had to like make sure that we didn't screw those things up.
You couldn't,
and like, I was like, oh my God,
into the river.
Today the National Treasure 2, you would not have been able to do that.
Be able to make either one.
No, the lemons on the back of the Declaration of Independence would have been sacrilege. So so we didn't, like, now we should rewatch, we would have a bigger appreciation, because I do remember walking into the clue room and just being like, oh my God, you guys did such an amazing job, it's like beautiful, and from this building the sets, and they do it so fast in television, everything happens so fast, and then the clue wall, and it was just like amazing. So, and it's always those little, and then it's continuity. It's like you're filming things out of order. So you're like, you're worried about, oh, was that sticky there when Billy comes in, and what did they see? What, you know, so that, so you're not able to enjoy as much of that. So I'm glad you guys are analyzing it. It's fun.
I'm glad that you're glad that we're doing it and that we're not annoying you.
I love that there was that such detail that people could go in, because we wanted the show to be filled with Easter eggs and fun stuff for people to go Google. You know, you want to Google everything that they like the double Alamo thing. That was such a fun thing. Or Elvis's grandma, you know, being a Native American, like all that stuff is true and it's fun. And, you know, you want people to edutainment, have fun with it.
Yep. Okay. So this is honestly, there's no good way to tie this question into what we were just talking about. But in Edge of History essentially implies that Agent Sadusky and or his son Jack secured the obsidian box and hid it in the Baton Rouge Masonic Lodge. So we know that Raphael and or Cross S. Nostrum had the box previously. So our question is, how did the Saduskis ultimately take possession of the box?
Okay. So
I'm glad you asked this question.
Did we have a chart on this one too?
We
somewhere?
Have a chart on
I have
this
to
one,
find this
sure.
chart too.
The box in Cibola.
So the Cibola one box, yeah, the jade box was from Cibola. The Masons took that. And the obsidian box was Raphael got it out of the church. Crosses Nostrum tried to steal it, but he got it to his wife, told her to call the number, and Peter Sadusky's people got Manuela the box and baby Jess out of there. So they got the box. Peter Sadusky got the box at that moment. They helped her get out.
This is why Marianne says his people. Because it wasn't personally Peter Sadusky, but
it was the Masons.
But nobody really knows, because when Jess walks into his door, you're like, does he have Alzheimer?
Or does he know her?
Who she is. And
so we had to separate them a little bit. Otherwise, he would go, hey, you're Manuela's daughter. You look just like her. So we had to, you know, but it's his group, the Masons helped her. Raphael called the Masons. He was an infiltrator in Cross S. Nostrum. He was never a full member of Cross S. Nostrum. He was never a real member. He was always a spy. He figured out what they were doing. He got the box away from them before they could get it. He gives it to Manuel and they get across the border and it goes away. So that's how it got hidden. But I had to look it up because I couldn't remember. It's a lot.
That explains so much.
Our minds are blown a little.
Okay, good.
And
yeah.
It explains, because one of our other questions was going to be like, what was the relationship between Raphael and Cross S. Nostrum pre-show? Because they clearly knew each other from that whole altercation in the church. But that was something we had. And obviously, Billy later was led to believe that Raphael was the one that killed her brother. Like, there was a relationship there.
Yeah, you know,
he was full on Donnie Brasco.
He was Donnie Brasco.
He'd gotten in there.
He was infiltrating.
And he needed their clues in order to crack it. And then he...
It's funny that got lost in the final cut, because that wasn't really important that he was a spy. Like, we originally had
They had turned... They felt like he had turned on him, but really he was ever working for them. He was just infiltrating them.
Yeah, he was... Yeah, he didn't... Yeah, exactly.
He wasn't working with them.
Yeah, I think he felt like he was working for real treasure hunters, like along the side of his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Realized that they were bad people, and then realized he had to save the treasure from these bad people. So in a way, he was kind of a spy.
Yeah.
And in fact, talking about set decorators and prop people, I think originally when Raphael scribbles a little note to Manuela, we had at one time Peter Sadusky's name written there, and then we realized it was too close that he wouldn't remember who they are, and so we couldn't. It had to just be a Masonic.
As Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah.
I love that.
The president snuck him across the board.
The president helped.
That would, ooh, I love that. Continuity. We love to see it. All right. So on the topic of Cross S. Nostrum, Emily and I have been really fascinated. We actually have an episode coming out later in our current season where we spend a whole episode kind of diagnosing the ethics and the motivations of Cross S. Nostrum. For the record, we think Cross S. Nostrum is so timely. Like, their story is so timely. It's so interesting. So just congratulations on that, number one.
Thank you.
My question is about our good friend Agent Hendrix. Question number 12. Why was Agent Hendrix drawn to Cross S. Nostrum? What was his motivation for joining the organization and becoming Salazar?
Well, we like to think like every shadow government, Skull and Crossbones sort of secret group, that they feel like they're doing it for the best. Like the little people don't really know how to run the world, but we do, and we're going to do it. Forget the elections and all that stuff. We can make them believe that they're controlling things, but we control everything. And they believe that's a benevolent, they don't believe they're bad guys by any means. Right. So he believed the same thing that Billy believed, which is we have to protect the status quo. You know, there was a line, I don't know if it's in the movie, in the show, if it made it, but when the have-nots realize that they used to have, they'll try to take us down because they used to have, they want it back. Yeah. So that's the whole reparations, everything that was happening. And they were like, man, that's just going to cause war. So we don't want war. We also don't want them to know. So let's just like cover it up. So in his head, he was like, we're just making sure we're stopping wars by, you know, it's like if you deleted, like if there were 12 commandments instead of 10, and they're like, those other two commandments are going to really fuck everything up. So let's just break that tablet so that nobody knows, you know, that's how they think. He thinks he's doing the right thing.
They want status quo, and they never wanted the status quo to change. And because when status quo changes, then bad things, people get killed, there's revolutions and whatnot. So Billy lived that on a personal level. She was in the streets in London in an IRA bombing, and it killed her family. And she saw it personally, and she lost her family because of rebellion. And so that kind of got her involved into it. But the higher ups of this whole thing was like, look, the world's working fine the way it is. We don't need to make any changes, because as soon as you start making changes, people start getting upset and it causes death and violence. So why don't we just keep it all the same? This treasure is very dangerous, because if it gets out there, people are going to start thinking, wait a minute.
And I think there was one we hinted at in an Egyptian treasure that got burned because if people had found this treasure, mm-hmm. same thing would happen. I can't remember which pharaoh it was, but it was the same idea. The Egyptians can't know.
We would go down this, Marianne and I would go down this research, and we go, they don't want to change anything because, you know, they got these oil fields, and if they don't own those oil fields anymore, and they're like, don't, you're getting too involved.
Like, getting too political.
Okay, but forget that.
Little did you know we were going to be asking you about those in-depth details, you know, yeah. A year later.
Now we have the answers.
We've completely backed out of it. Now you're asking us, yeah, we're going to send you the flow charts. And you're going to be like, complete insanity.
And I think we told you that we had originally, if the movie hadn't come out, Cross S. Nostrum was going to be page 47. Mm-hmm. But then we couldn't, you know, because we thought it was a big enough idea that, you know, what's bigger than Templar and Cibola? That's hard.
The shadow government.
Shadow government that's trying to hide treasures and, you know, delete our
history,
past.
History
of the world, you know, feels like a page 47 conspiracy. But we didn't get that approved.
It would also go along with what John's told us, which is what if what's on page 47 isn't a good thing? Right, like
I'm glad he said that. Yeah. Oh, okay. that tease, John Turteltaub.
Yeah, exactly.
Good.
In preparation for one of our recent episodes, Aubrey and I both watched Lara Croft Tomb Raider, which depicts the Illuminati in a manner that's actually very similar to Cross S. Nostrum. Was Cross S. Nostrum like inspired by the Illuminati, or was it just kind of like, we just want this group of people who are trying to, like you were saying, like keep the status quo, control everything?
I would say they're inspired by all those groups.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that we'd seen it. I don't know.
We hadn't seen it in a long time, but
Illuminati,
But Illuminati comes up a lot when you talk about the Masons.
And... Yeah, the bad Illuminati. Yeah, we're big fans of those things. So we didn't have a time machine at the end of ours. So.
I know. We told you we can't do anything awesome. Supernatural in awesome. National Treasure movies, but yeah.
Which we thank you for. We like it better that way without the supernatural.
Yeah. No spear of destiny or anything like that.
But yeah, I mean, that's a cool thing. The in Lara Croft, that's the first one, right? Tomb Raider.
Yeah, that's the first one, and yeah, they're a cool evil group. And I think everybody can get behind a bad guy that's like an evil shadow government, evil.
Yeah.
You know.
100%.
Yeah. Yeah, especially the original ones that, like, no women are allowed. It's like, screw that. Yeah.
Indeed. All right, so we've obviously asked you a ton of super easy questions up until this point. I'm going to ask you an even easier question. Number 14, do you think it was ethically or morally acceptable for Raphael to let Manuela and Jess believe he had died?
I do. I mean, like,
his value system was the greater good, right?
Yeah, he was afraid for their lives too. He actually sent them across the border with the box, so they could have been killed if everyone didn't believe Raphael died with the box on him. So I guess he felt like he was saving their lives, and then also the greater good, which he says to Jess. He says, look, this is bigger than you and me. That's why I'm in prison. I don't, you know, he's like, it's bigger than we are. But it was fun when she gets really mad at him. Like and when she sees him in jail, she's like, oh, not all happy to see daddy. She's like, hey, fuck us. You abandon us, you know? Like, so that was fun. That was a fun thing to play with because, like, we're blood. How dare you?
Well, that becomes Jess's arc towards the latter half, right? I mean, he sits there and he says, look, man, this is bigger than all of us. I did to Mitch. You remember Mitch? And, you know, I sacrificed myself for but anyway, so Jess now for the rest of it has got to, like, suddenly the treasure becomes more important to her than anything. And it wasn't
because it wasn't there
until the history, till he presents it to her, and they kind of change places. If you see, he becomes, Jess's life is more important to him than the treasure at the end. And hers, you know, we got to do what you set out to do. At least that's what we intended.
Yeah, when they're locked in that trap.
We intended.
He's like, you're right. I was wrong. I missed your first step. I missed your, you know, maybe this was stupid. Why is stupid pursuit? It means nothing. So, yeah.
So
we tried to do that.
We tried.
That's great. Okay, so we talked about John Turtletaub a lot, like just randomly kind of throughout this thus far. So question 15 is, you've obviously worked with John Turtletaub in some capacity on both movies and the Edge of History series. Can you tell us, like, a secret about working with John behind the scenes?
Did we tell you that he, right before we were going to shoot National Treasure 1, he always, first, let me preface this with, he questions everything. And that's what it keeps you on your toes. Because he's like, what is Ben thinking in the scene? Why is he doing this? He's always at, and you might be thinking of the scene that you're rewriting. So it's like really hard to, like, it's like, well, we've left that scene behind, you know, 2 weeks ago, and that's your problem now, whatever. So he's always asking questions, but he'll literally do things like, does it have to be a map on the back of the Declaration of Independence? He'll question to that level. He'll, like,
oh my God.
And then you go, yes, it does. It has to be a map on the back. So that is a secret about him, is he really does. He questions everything. But it makes you have to be your best at your job. Because he's smarter than everyone in the room.
Well, I think we've already told you guys the stories about John. I mean, we literally sat in a room with John and some of the producers for the first one for weeks, working out the story. And everything John, and you know, we think we have it, and he would question something. And then one day Jerry walked in and said, well, what do you got? And John pitched the whole story exactly like as if he believed in it all. And Jerry and Jerry said, that's it, let's go. And we're like,
but wow, you just made it work.
You just made it all work, but you were questioning everything for weeks. And we did the same thing on the second one. We sat in a room with John and Ted and Terry. We sat in there and figured out the story, you know, on a board and everything. So it's, you know, he's very much involved. He knows what he's doing. He questions everything like Marianne says. And then when you see him on the set, he's
commanding.
He's nice. He's a nice guy. You guys have seen him. He's funny. He's really smart.
Uh-huh. He has all the answers, even if he, you know, is asking all the questions.
That's the other thing. And he would do that to us on the set. We would be sitting in a room trying to write a scene. John would come in, what is this? And we'd go, and he's like, I don't understand. And then we walk on the set and John would walk up to the actor and explain it all to him. And Marianne and I, oh my God.
He just explained it better than we even understand.
He explains it better than we're. And it's his process is to question and then regurgitate him.
And he's just amazing with like the little touches. Like you guys can just see that, but like, it's not scripted that Riley does that with his pizza or, you know, whatever. It's like him and Justin Bartha riffing on the set or whatever they do. Like he's got really good comedy chops. So does Justin, but John's very, very funny. In addition to being smart.
It's in all of his movies. So.
Yeah. All the little touches that he does. He's gold. You know, he's our favorite first everything choice all the time.
That sounds about right. As academics, Emily, I don't know if you agree with this. He gives like thesis advisor vibes.
Oh, 100%. But like thesis advisor.
That's funny. I like that. He'll like that if you tell him that.
Okay, we'll tell him that then.
I don't know if we should tell him that. I don't know. He might go too far with it.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Okay, all right. Well, you knew we were going to get here eventually. National Treasure 3. So question number 16, since Edge of History concluded, have you been in touch with the team working on the third film? Are you working with them, you know, now that the show has wrapped? Tell us everything.
I mean, we have met with the writer post strike. We had lunch with him and his wife, and he was close to finishing a draft. Because we weren't supposed to write during the strike. So he wasn't. He was abiding by the rules. And that's the last we've heard. So we don't know. You know, but he was close. So that was a while ago. So they must have a few drafts since then. It's always a few drafts. That was just going to be his first draft. So there is a writer working on it as far as we know. But we don't know what state it's in. And he was a big fan of the show. And he did think, you know, he was like,
or at least he got all the way through it.
He did, you know, like everybody, it was kind of slow starting, you know, the series. The first half isn't as good as the second half. And he really enjoyed how he said, we stuck the landing, you stuck the landing. So I think he really was thinking about that when he was right. Who knows if he's going to incorporate any of the ideas or characters or anything from the show, but we always want, you know, believe that the two exist in the same universe. So he had hinted at it, but we don't know. Okay. We don't know where, even if we had asked him and he told us, we wouldn't be able to say, but we don't know.
Makes sense. Okay. So, I mean, you're very familiar with Aubrey and I, like throwing out a lot of theories regarding everything. But what's the most surprising or interesting fan theory that you've seen or heard regarding the movies, the show, or, because we're on the topic, National Treasure 3?
What are some of the fan theories? Like, what do you guys hear? Like, I don't know that, like, I would love to hear some. Like, what do people think that it's gonna be? Have we hinted at it in any way other than page 47? And
yeah, I think people have really the most common area of fan theory is like, what is on page 47, right? And I feel like most of the people that we see, they're just not that creative. You know, it's like It's like Blackbeard's treasure, or like, you know, a something that I wouldn't necessarily consider like world changing in the way that we're led to believe that page 47 is. Also, we don't think that like the identity of a treasure, like the treasure name, is on page 47. That just wouldn't jive. It needs, we think it needs to be like a clue or the revelation of something, some entity or person or something existing to kind of start the treasure hunt.
Right.
But yeah, I guess when, let me, maybe I can change the question a bit. As the show was airing, did you see any fun theories online of fans who were trying to guess the ending or figure out who Salazar was? Did anyone guess it was Hendrix? Like anything like that?
I didn't see anybody guess it was Hendrix. It did get spoiled by the soundtrack. So a few people got, I guess there was a,
really?
A release of the soundtrack. And in the soundtrack, they do temp titles for the tracks. And one of the temp titles, I think it was number 8 or 9, was Hendrix's Salazar, which was just the, was just supposed to be the temp name of the song. And it made it to the final. And I got this panic text from Lisette, who plays Jess, and she said, there's a spoiler in the soundtrack. I was like, what? I was like, oh no. And it had already kind of made it through Twitter a little bit, but I guess then Disney tried to put the kibosh on it. But but no, and other than that, people didn't see it coming. So that was good. Did you guys predict it? I can't remember when you guys were watching it. You
no,
guys
didn't. We didn't.
No, we loved had no it, idea.
Okay, good. And I feel like the actors that we had told had forgotten by the time we got there too. So when we gave them the script, they were like, oh yeah. Like Armando knew and he kept it a secret the whole time.
Yeah, Armando, we were told that Armando like straight up like told some people like the wrong thing.
Oh, he just flat out lied.
Yeah. Good for him.
I love him for that. I think he said, I think Lyndon, who plays Agent Ross, said, I broke bread with you. We had meals together and you never told me. Like,
she was, yeah, you were going to stab me in the back.
You were going to stab me in the back.
Literally.
But no, I know what you're saying now about like Blackbeard's. I think I have read stuff like that. And I was like, no, that's not, I see those kind of theories. And I go, no, that's not big enough. That's not big enough. None of those big enough, you know. Even for season 2 of National Treasure, the TV show, you know, it's two things that you have to come up with. It's time period, so like Revolutionary War for one, Civil War for two, the discovery of the Americas for the show, and then, but for the season 2, we were gonna have to come up with another time period for America. And so we were going to do the gold rush. I think we told you that.
Oh, we didn't know that for certain. Okay, it was
the gold rush. Were going to do the gold rush. It's not happening now, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. We can tell you. And then we were going to try to intersect it with an international treasure that we can't, I don't think we should say, in case they use, I don't know, we don't know, but we were going to try to, you know, branch out of the Americas. Like kind of like what we did with 2 when we went to England and did, you know, all that fun stuff with Buckingham Palace and stuff like that. But so that's an important thing. And for 3 too, they have to pick a time period. There's the War of 1812 and there's the war of, I don't know, other things. So there's like, we have our whole pirate history. We have a lot of things that you can, I don't think they're going to be gold rush, but there's a lot of things that, you know, so that's one thing you have to pick, and then you have to pick the treasure.
Well, it's so much later. I mean, you just like, you have to decide where is Ben's headspace. What is he doing? Is he walking into a college class and there's no one there because he's so old and no one cares about his history anymore? Like, what is Ben Gates doing at this point?
Is he big?
Trying to teach a class and no one cares
about history anymore?
Abigail and she's busy and the dog won't pay attention to him. It's like, what? And then what treasure is he going to go after? That would be interesting to see where they put him and what his dilemma is.
Yeah, what his personal dilemma is. Yeah, and like we said in 2, it was, they're broken up. You know, you have that. So there's 3 things. It's the personal story. It's the historical period in the background, and it's the treasure. Mm-hmm. Those 3 have to tie together thematically. Good luck. It's like, not our problem.
Glad it's not our problem
right now.
Oh man. Well, all that makes perfect sense. And Disney, if you need ideas, call us.
I know. I keep saying that. Disney, listen to these podcasts, because these gals can be your researchers for sure.
We would do it in a heartbeat too.
You guys have heard all the ideas too. So like, you know, probably every treasure and every possible idea that.
Have you heard of the Amber Room? We did a whole episode.
Amber Room is cool. The Amber Room is very cool.
Especially why was it given from one country to the other as a gift to secure an alliance? There's like a way to manipulate history there and to create a story. Yeah. Or was it actually stolen or was it hidden somewhere? There's so much there. Anyway.
That's a good one. Now, just 3 people, listen up.
Oh man, they're gonna have a lot of back catalog to get through with our podcast though, honestly. It's a lot now. All right, we only have a couple more questions left, but this is, I can't believe how much we've learned every time we talk to you. It's amazing. Here's one that we've wondered about quite a bit. This is number 18. Many people, as you know, have compared National Treasure to franchises like Lara Croft, Indiana Jones, The Mummy, all of which have been heavily merchandised, video games, theme park attractions, you name it. Why do you think Disney chose not to merchandise National Treasure in this way?
You know, it's interesting. What was our box office? Our box office was pretty good, but it's not Star Wars box office. It's not.
I think it was 360 for the first one and 480 for the second.
And what was Indiana Jones? I mean, it's probably a lot more. Maybe box office have something to do with it. But look, I think there would be a great ride that was set in Mount Rushmore with the Sepulveda Caves. You could totally do a great ride there. And I don't know why, you know, it's like that it just didn't make their cut, you know, but it is a big family friendly franchise. It's people say that to us all the time. It's like a movie that I watched with my grandparents, or you know, when I was a kid, you know, and, or grandparents say it's a show that doesn't bore. I want to peel my eyeballs out because it's a kid show, but my kids love it, you know. So it would make a good Disney attraction.
They have like a whole America section in like Disney World, right?
That's another one. Yeah, that's right. They do. Huh. Yeah, that would be a good place for it too.
Right next to the Hall of Presidents.
I'm going there soon, so I'll try and
tell them.
Make some suggestions to people.
Yeah, they apparently had some of our props and some of Billy's designer wardrobe on display in the America's one. I don't know if it's still there, but Disney World. They had it there. So anyway, I don't know if it's still there. But
keep your eyes peeled, Em.
I'll look for it.
Send us a picture if you see it.
We'll do. Okay, so second to last question. You may have noticed that National Treasure has been referenced on social media many times in the last decade when, you know, fairly consequential events have occurred in our country. Why do you think that National Treasure remains so relevant today?
Yeah, what did Rachel Maddow, like, it was like in a negative light with Rachel Maddow. I can't remember. She said something, I should look it up, but, and I remember, you know, because it became sort of unpopular to be patriotic for a little while there. Right. But the movies are unabashedly patriotic. And I think that's the appeal. You know, the stuff that we love about America and American history, the movies embrace it and celebrate it. And really it's a treasure hunt. It's fun, and but it has this little history lesson in the background, with a character that's just truly, truly,
I mean, stealing the Declaration of Independence, it's a crazy thing to do.
I mean, that, you know, that quote, like, that's it. like there, you know, like that wasn't us. So we can say, I mean, that's the biggest deal right there is like, it's just such a crazy idea. And I know Nick Cage said that recently on social media.
Very recently. Yeah.
Yeah. That, I mean, it's just, it is such a kooky thing to say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence.
Well, we did write that.
So, you know, that, I guess.
I'm going to steal it for him. Well, yeah, I don't know.
And then, of course, it gets used when Trump takes the documents and puts it in his bathroom. And, you know, everybody, it's an honor, I guess, that you're becoming me.
Well, it's used, that's the thing, it's used in to poke fun at situations like that. But it's also when you have everything from major Supreme Court decisions coming down to, you know, the Capitol insurrection and everything, people are using the line, it means when there's something wrong, those who have the ability to take action have the responsibility to take action. That pops up a lot in these sorts of times, you know, the current events that we're talking about.
Yes, it did pop up a lot for the insurrection. It did.
But people use it in both ways. They use it to support the decisions made by the insurrectionists, right. Yeah. But also by the people who are saying this is clearly a problem and we need to do something about what the insurrectionists have done. You know, it speaks to everyone.
Maybe just because it was Nick Cage, we had no idea Nick Cage would be so, like, he's so quirky that everyone just loves him so much. So.
He's the only one that could deliver that line.
Yeah, 100%. Aubrey tries sometimes, but it doesn't go over as well.
He's the only one.
I'm no Nick Cage. What can I say? Well, this has been a marathon, and we are so grateful for your time today. So number 20, NT20 questions. You've touched on this a little bit before, but you know, for the record here, we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of National Treasure as we speak. In a couple years, we'll be celebrating, what, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. There's a lot of relevant events here. We would love to see one of these occasions used to green light National Treasure 3, to see National Treasure 3 come out. What can you tell us about any hopes or dreams or, you know, for National Treasure 3, from your perspective as people who have been so ingrained in the whole franchise?
I think that it has its best chance now. I think it has the best writer that of all the writers they've hired, it's the one that knows the franchise. So we're, Marianne and I were very, like, it's like we always say, it looks like it's a silly script and
silly idea,
and it looks like
preposterous, I should say.
I mean, it's easy to do, but this, it's in good hands, and you know, John's wants to do it, and I think they're getting around to now going back to those sort of franchises. So you know, before there was so many other franchises that was making so much money for them that they couldn't really, well, but we'll lose money by making this, we'll make money, but we'll lose money. Because
we could have made Star Wars something.
Or we could have made, you know, this other Marvel movie that, you know, which, and look, you can't blame them, but I think it's starting to swing back that, like, look, people are ready for this. Just like, you know, when Brooke Harbour did the next Top Gun, I think they're ready for the next National Treasure. And I think they're ready for it. To see it with different eyes, and I think the critics would see it with different eyes, just like they saw the second Top Gun with different eyes. So I think they would. So I just feel like it's building. I think we have our best chance now than we've ever had.
I like that answer. I think people are, you know, country's so divided, and it just would be. I just love the celebration of America, you know, in a really corny sort of way that National Treasure does it, you know, the way that Nick Cage, that Ben Gates is. And I would love to see it. I don't know what they're going to do, but I would love to see, you know, a new generation somehow in there, worked in there, kind of like what they did with Top Gun is a really good example. Yeah. You know, they brought in Goose's, you know, son.
So they made it so that's what they're going to have to do with National Treasure, something like that. You missed this one question. Marianne had a really good answer of like, what would you put on the back of the Declaration of Independence?
What would I put back on it?
Let's do it. Let's ask the question. Bonus question number 21. What would you, if you could leave a message on the back of the Declaration of Independence that would be preserved for all of time, much like a map to a treasure, but what would it be?
Marianne's answer, she'd put in quotes, read the front of this document.
Oh, I love it.
Come on. The message is still relevant. Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I just thought, you know.
That's beautiful.
You know,
I thought that was a good answer.
That's one of the other questions we asked in our On the Street interviews, and people would give some pretty poignant answers. Like people were saying, like, the definition, like what we mean by equality, what we mean by all men. You know, others would say just like a giant appendix going into more detail based on what we see on the front, you know.
Or a Wordle.
Wordle. Oh, by the way, also alternate casting for Abigail was Holly Hunter. Holly Hunter back in the day.
Ah.
That we really, she was kind of like, you could see her as a curator.
Like, very nice.
Yeah, and Denzel Washington, but I didn't know. We didn't know. Like Denzel Washington going a different way for Nick Cage, the Ben Gates character. Anyway.
Very cool. Well, I mean, really quickly, now that we're wrapped up here, was there anything you wanted to talk about here today that we didn't get to?
Oh my God. I'm always so curious about all your answers to all these questions. I mean, that's why I always look at this and I was like, oh, what would Emily and Aubrey say? Like,
it's just so nice that our crazy flowcharts that you guys actually are thinking this, so that it doesn't go to waste. You're like, oh, good, somebody's thinking about it.
Write this down, flowchart.
Spend all this time working on a flowchart to explain.
Well, what you don't get to see is our little note sheet that we're working off of here. And we type little notes to each other here and there, especially when you say something and we're like, oh my God, that's what we thought. We're so proud we figured that out ourselves. Yeah, that's a fun time.
That's good.
That is fun. Yeah. That is fun. I love game too.
Well, thank you both again so much for taking the time. This has been an absolute blast as usual.
Yeah,
it was so much fun talking to you guys. We always love it. Well, we love it.
Thank you for doing this.
Really. Thank you for being such how do you say
curator
historians of the franchise. I mean, you guys really are, like, we're so lucky to have you. So thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that means the world. Thank you. Emily, I cannot breathe. I cannot breathe with how much we learned in that episode. My brain is spinning.
It's amazing how every time we go into these episodes, I'm like, we have all these questions, but I'm concerned that we're not really gonna like learn anything new. Like, we've already touched on everything. We haven't, clearly.
Clearly. Okay. First of all, Sadusky was faking dementia himself? That broke me. It broke me. And it was like one of the first questions we asked, or like it felt like it was very early in the interview. And I'm still putting the puzzle pieces back together in my head with that new piece of information. Also, infant Jess and her mother were the ones to smuggle the obsidian box across the border? What?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this goes to show how much, like, gets cut from the ideas that the writers and the producers have to the final product.
And you know what, Em? I don't know if you kind of read through this after the recording, but Marianne, of course, made good on her promise and sent us the clue trails for National Treasure 2. And I looked through them the other day. They are so dense. I think we're going to have to do a whole episode breaking them down in season 9.
Yeah. And I just want to say thank you again to Marianne, because that is going to be very helpful for me in every future watch of Book of Secrets.
Well, yeah. And then how about Cormac's belief that we are closer than we have ever been to National Treasure 3?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I feel like we knew it. We wanted to believe it, but it's been confirmed, the belief.
Well, I feel like our listeners know very well that I have long feared what the implications for the strikes could have been for National Treasure 3, since in theory so many things now need to get made. So it was, to me, it was a huge relief to hear that a script was complete very soon after the writer's strike ended. It's not like the idea to do the movie like disappeared or got shoved to the back burner, and we know that they're still working on it now. Hi, National Treasure Hunters. This is Aubrey coming to you live from the future. Okay, so if you have been listening to this bonus episode around the time that it came out, you should know that we actually recorded this interview with the Wibberleys just a couple weeks ago. It's pretty recent. But even so, after that interview happened, a short but let's say loud article came online written by Screen Rant, in which Nicolas Cage was quoted as saying the following: "No, there is no National Treasure 3. If you want to find treasure, don't look at Disney, okay? It's not there," end quote. And because the Wibberleys talked about National Treasure 3 in the interview, specifically saying that as of the end of the writer's strike, the script was ongoing, I just wanted to pop in here really quick to allay some concerns that the Screen Rant article may have, you know, brought up in some listeners. And I wanted to share that per our sources, the National Treasure 3 script is still being written and worked on actively as we speak, as you are listening to the rest of this episode, okay? I think Nicolas Cage has a lot of reason to be frustrated, especially with Disney, regarding how slow-moving National Treasure 3 progress has been since 2007. And I think that's probably pretty indicative of where his comments are coming from. But just wanted to give you that little piece of intel. Don't fret, y'all. It is still in the works. All right, let's get back to the outro.
If this wasn't enough for all of you, we asked the Wib some bonus questions, and we are going to be providing those video clips on our social media platforms.
So do you want to tell them where those platforms are?
You can find us and these video clips on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast.
And should I tease like the topics of one or two vids? I feel like I have to.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, was Sorwana a daughter of the plumed serpent? It's something we've been asking ourselves for a while. And here's a good one. We didn't even think we were going to ask this question, but the conversation devolved into it. Is anyone else bugged by the story about the rabbit that Jess used to open the first box on the bus in like episode 2 of Edge of History? Guess what, y'all? We're going to reveal to you the origins of that rabbit story.
Yes. I feel like if you've been listening to us, you know that we've had a lot of questions on the rabbit.
Question will be answered. So don't forget to follow us at NT Hunt Podcast, like Emily said, and continue to tune in to National Treasure Hunt on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen all year round, because we are continuing our celebration of the 20th anniversary of National Treasure. So until then, I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And thank you so much for joining us on our National Treasure Hunt.